Thank you for tuning in to CITR 101.9 FM. You're listening to Democracy Watch, the News Collective's weekly hour-long news report, bringing you alternative and undercovered current affairs from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. My name is Alex DeBoer.
I'm Andy Laidman.
And I am Alamdi Alanion.
It's Thursday, August 23rd at approximately 5:05. We're broadcasting from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. This Wednesday, myself, Andy Laidman, and fellow News Collective member Aidan Tong reach Coalition of Progressive Electors City Council candidate Jean Swanson by phone to talk about the 4 days she recently served in prison for breaking a court injunction on Kinder Morgan's Burnaby Tank Farm facility. During the interview, we also discuss Jean's run for council, as well as why she hopes to follow in Harry Rankin's footsteps as an activist councillor.
But we're going to start today's show with an interview with the director of UBC Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions. He's also a political science professor. His name's Max Cameron. You've probably heard his name in the news in the past couple months. He spoke with News Collective member Andy Laidman, who's in studio with me now, about BC's upcoming electoral reform referendum, which is happening in October. He talked about why it's important and why you should vote in it. So let's go to that now.
Hey, this is Andy Laidman. Just a quick note before we begin. This piece was produced in studio at CITR, and unfortunately you may notice there's a bit of background noise at times. Sorry about that. Between October 22nd and November 30th, 2018, BC residents will vote in a referendum on electoral reform. This mail-in referendum will decide whether BC wants what's referred to as a proportional representation system, or PR, an electoral system in which parties gain seats in proportion to the number of votes cast for them. BC has already held two referendums on the issue of proportional representation, once in 2005 and once in 2009. Both votes failed to meet the threshold required for PR to pass. However, this time around, three different variations of PR are being offered to British Columbians, including mixed member proportional, dual member proportional, and rural-urban proportional. There will also be an option to keep our current system, first past the post. The way the referendum is being worded has also changed from past votes. This October's ballot will begin with a general question asking whether our current electoral system should change to PR, followed by a second question asking which type of PR would be best. Attorney General David Eby and proponents of electoral reform believe that this ballot structure will enable voters to prioritize the decision to either adopt PR or stay with the current system, rather than focusing overly on what type of PR system might work best. But will the referendum inspire public interest in real change in our electoral system? To answer these questions, I spoke to UBC political science professor and director of the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions, Maxwell Cameron. One idea that came up repeatedly when chatting with Max was his desire to see public deliberations between citizens and politicians so that citizens can shape the debate around PR. In the absence of more direct input from BC citizens, Max emphasizes the importance of Elections BC in providing ample information to voters in this referendum.
Well, I do wish that we had a more meaningful process of public deliberation to make that easier, and I do believe that Elections BC or some other body needs to be instructed to produce material that gives the voters the information that they need to make an informed decision. There is no way that voters can be asked to decide on three different systems unless they're given relatively, you know, accurate and sufficiently detailed information so that they can make that choice. I think that, you know, one of the problems for electoral reform has always been that those who advocate it don't necessarily converge on a particular system. And so the reason for having two-part ballot structure is to, first of all, figure out how many people actually want to change the system versus want to keep the status quo. And then if it's a majority of people who want to change the system, well, then we've got the option of ranking ballots so we can figure out what most people would prefer. Mm-hmm. I don't think that there's any need for the Yes campaign to converge on one outcome, nor do I think that it would be appropriate for the government to recommend one of the three. I think that that is the sort of thing that we would want voters to decide with the best possible information. Is that a task for which they are unequipped? Not in principle. I think what people need to understand, and I think this is actually where most voters are, is let's understand what are the basic principles and properties and potential implications of these systems. Think about that in relation to the things that we value. So you look at things like how proportional is the system, how much does it retain a sense of local representation, what do the alternative systems mean in terms of the magnitude of districts? Do we want people to be able to select individual candidates as well as parties and things like that? And then you look at the systems and you pick the one that you like the most. I frankly think that any of the three alternatives would be better than the status quo. And so I would not have a problem with voting yes for PR, but then, you know, leaving blank my choice with regard to the system. So if people don't feel comfortable with figuring out which of the three systems they like, but they do like the principle of proportionality and they think it's important, then they can do that. We could then have a conversation about individual systems, and there are clearly pros and cons to each. What I need to know as a voter is, what's the ballot going to look like? How big are the districts that I'm voting in? And will the result reflect the will of the people? And am I comfortable with the way in which it will do so? And I don't think that's a challenge that's above the capacity of the ordinary voter to do. I actually think that if you look at what the government has done so far, they've actually done a bit of a disservice to the whole process of electoral reform by not having a deeper public engagement. I think they're actually risking a no outcome, or what would be even worse would be a very low level of turnout with a very closely divided result in which the yes side is heavily concentrated in the lower mainland and the no side is concentrated in the interior. And then you are going to have real serious questions about what kind of mandate the government actually has. And yet if it doesn't proceed, it's going to alienate the Green Party, which is the basis of its survival as a minority government. So I think that there's a kind of a potential very negative scenario for the government shaping up as a result of the way it's tried to be even-handed. I like the specific proposals they put on the table. I think it's good that they are moving ahead with a referendum, but they haven't actually put in place the kind of process that would really, I think, avoid the kind of polarization that referenda are inevitably prone to and that we're already seeing in this process. You know, I think it's really, quite frankly, an issue in which many voters are either not particularly motivated or interested to find out a lot about electoral reform. I mean, it's not a bread and butter issue. It's not something that's going to hit people in their pocketbook. This is something that is a bit more abstract. It's about the rules of the game for our political process. And that's something that politicians and activists and people who are deeply engaged already with the policy process care about. But it's not necessarily an issue that a lot of voters do. And I think one of the questions we have to really ask is what would be an appropriate level of or expected level of turnout. If, in fact, people don't vote, then I think you have to be able to interpret that to some extent as being a vote of indifference. It may be that the vote is ultimately decided by the people who really care. Obviously, I think it would be much better if we had a robust turnout, high level of interest, and a highly informed electorate. Short of that, I think what we would hope to see would be a clear mandate or clear statement of what those who actually care about the issue think, and let's hope that that is a reasonable percentage of the public. I think what would be bad would be to have an outcome that's hard to interpret involving a relatively small number of voters. Youth participation is crucial. I think one of the reasons why people don't like voting or find themselves unhappy about the experience of voting is they have to vote strategically. They can't vote for who they really believe in. So electoral reform, I think in that sense, we know that it has a mild effect on turnout, and it's positive. You get more turnout in PR elections than you do in first-past-the-post elections, all held equal. And I suspect that that's something that youth are likely to care about, because I think youth probably feel as strongly as anybody about strategic voting as a problem.
One issue that has been raised repeatedly in the media is the potential for far-right, nativist, or other extremist parties to gain ground in BC under proportional representation system. I asked Max to help me understand the likelihood of this happening.
If the fear is neo-Nazi-style parties, nowhere in Europe are those parties influential, right? And they're not going to happen here in BC. There's no constituency for neo-Nazis or for extremist anti-democratic politics. That's not a problem we've had in our politics, and changing electoral rules isn't going to create that problem. If you look across Europe, the thing to be worried about are nativist parties and populist parties. Populist parties win broad majorities. So electoral systems are not going to insulate us against, you know, the rise of people like Doug Ford. In terms of nativist parties, yes. I think you can get parties that have not a lot of support, but enough support that they have an influence within the legislature. Either they become a pole within the legislature that begins to draw people in their direction, or they even become potentially coalition partners in certain circumstances. And they, so nativist parties are really parties about preserving the traditional polity and preventing immigration and, you know, the sort of conservative, they don't like multiculturalism and so forth. I think we've gone so far down the path of multiculturalism, it's so broadly accepted, and it's so successful in our society. I think that's a little unlikely. But, you know, it is very hard to predict the future. And, you know, if it were to happen, I would be really surprised if it would be a consequence of electoral reform.
Thanks for listening. This interview was conducted, edited, and researched by me, Andy Laidman, and featured UBC Professor of Political Science, Maxwell Cameron. Again, the referendum on PR runs from October 22nd to November 30th of this year. If you're interested in learning more about the different systems of PR or interested in finding out how the proposed system will affect you or the electoral district you live in, more information can be found at elections.bc.ca.
All right, you're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. We'll be right back after a short break.
You forgot the surfboards? How are we going to shred the gnarly waves now?
Well, I got just the replacement. I picked up some copies of Discorder instead.
Well, it looks like this surf day just got a whole lot better.
This extra special summer issue of Discorder features interviews with local punk rockers Lié, queer Métis fashion designer Evan Ducharme, and the hosts of CITR's Radio Pizza Party. There will also be an exclusive Bartholomew comic strip, short fiction by Mac Gordon, and a suggested summer reading list compiled by the staff of Massey Books. And of course, there will be reviews of the Music Waste and Sled Island Music Festivals, as well as podcasts, films, and more. Thank you to our advertisers Blueprint, Timber Concerts, The Cinematheque, Rickshaw Theater, Mint Records, Existential Festival, Current Symposium, Audiopile, and An Evening in Damascus. Timber Concerts and CITR present Superorganism with guest Uno, Friday, August 31st at the Imperial. Tickets are available at Red Cat Records, Zulu Records, or online.
Welcome back. You're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. My name's Alex DeBoer. You just heard a piece on the upcoming proportional representation referendum this October, and we're now going to turn our focus to something a little bit more specific to Vancouver. So Vancouver has an upcoming municipal election on October 20th, like the rest of the municipalities, and this week we had an opportunity to speak with COPE, or the Coalition of Progressive Electors, City Council candidate Jean Swanson. You've probably heard about her in the news lately, as she just got out of jail for protesting the Kinder Morgan pipeline expansion. So we had a chance to speak with her, and let's take a listen to that interview.
Jean Swanson is a local activist and City Council hopeful who has been engaged in civil disobedience for a long time. You've probably read about her recent stint in jail after she protested against the government's purchase of the Trans Mountain Pipeline last weekend. But her history of breaking the law to disrupt what she sees as unjust systems isn't new.
Tax the rich to house the poor! Tax the rich to house the poor! Tax the rich!
The chanting and disruption prompted councillors to leave, and the protesters took advantage of the empty chamber to run the meeting they were hoping to have. Jean Swanson of the Carnegie Community Action Project took the chair of Mayor Gregor Robertson. Though he wasn't here today, she then began chairing the mock or impromptu meeting as other protesters took councillor seats. They then began speaking about what they want to see from the city.
People are dying of homelessness. It's not something that's, it's urgent. We need immediate action. Winter is coming. We have over 2,000 homeless people on the street in Vancouver. There's even shelters are only enough shelters for less than half of them. The tent city is being evicted. We just lost 173 rooms at the Balmoral Hotel. People are going to die of homelessness. They are dying of homelessness. Somebody has to do something now, starting now.
The clip you just heard is from a direct action that took place in January of last year. Jean Swanson and other anti-poverty advocates stormed City Hall, causing councillors to disperse. Though many couldn't have realized at the time, Jean's mock seat on council may have been a foreshadowing of what's to come after this October's municipal election. CITR News Collective members Aidan Tong and Andy Laidman reached Swanson by phone to talk about the 4 days she recently served in prison for breaking a court injunction on Kinder Morgan's Burnaby Tank Farm facility. Jean also discusses her run for council with Vancouver's Coalition of Progressive Electors, or COPE, as well as why she hopes to follow in Harry Rankin's footsteps as an activist councillor.
So you've been in Vancouver politics for decades, and you were featured in the recent documentary, The Rank and File. Can you tell us a bit about your history with Vancouver's politics, for example, when you first got involved and what instigated your involvement?
So back in the 70s, I worked at the Downtown Eastside Residents Association with Bruce Erickson and Libby Davies, and that's when Harry Rankin was on city council. And we were working to improve conditions in the Downtown Eastside, get higher welfare rates, the maintenance bylaws for the SROs, stop tax buyers from ripping people off, things like that. Yeah, and we worked with Harry Rankin. We always said he was on the inside and we were on the outside. You know, he kind of, even though he wasn't the majority, he helped us get things happening in the Downtown Eastside. He was kind of an activist counselor, which is the kind that I would like to be. So then after that, I ran for council a few times. I ran for MLA. I'm probably the most defeated person in Vancouver. I ran for mayor in 1988 against Gordon Campbell. Then after that, I didn't run for anything until the by-election last year where I came in second.
What instigated your involvement with COPE in particular?
Oh, well, because of Harry, because he always stuck up for us. Whatever we wanted, some changes in the Downtown Eastside, he would support us. He's the one that orchestrated things so that we got the standards of maintenance bylaw passed. He's the one that got us funding for the Carnegie Community Center.
You mentioned you did run as a mayoral candidate in 1988, and you do have that long history with COPE, but in the 2017 by-election, you actually chose to run as an independent. So why did you decide to run with COPE again this election?
Well, because I guess in 2017 I ran as an independent because the folks who came to me and asked me to run were independent. Some of them had had some connections with COPE, but they weren't really active in COPE at the time. But COPE endorsed me in the by-election. And so working with COPE in the by-election was a very positive experience. And it was great to work with Diana Day, who's their great Indigenous school board candidate. And so, yeah, I wanted to make that connection closer this time.
Okay. So you've been running on, running for local government on the same issues that you've been willing to, in some cases, break the law over through civil disobedience. If you're elected to city council, would you still use protest as a tool to challenge political agendas that you disagree with?
Sure, if necessary. I mean, you try the nice way first. It doesn't usually work. And then you gradually escalate, right? And then sometimes you end up having to do things that you'd rather not. But yeah, that's the way you get things done, I guess.
So, sorry, are you saying that you'd rather not use protests, but you find it's an effective tool?
Yeah. I mean, if we could write a letter to Justin Trudeau and say, please don't buy the pipeline. It's causing global warming. It could spill on the land and the sea, and it'll hurt the orcas. Instead, you could use all that money that you're spending to buy it to hire Alberta tar sands workers to build solar and wind power. And he said, oh, gosh, you're right. I'm going to do that instead. And there would be no use reason to protest. But he didn't say that. So
Jean, your time in jail has been quite publicized. So what do you say to those accusing your team's heavy social media focus on your time in jail as being primarily a campaign tactic?
Well, the idea of going to jail is to get more people aware of how important the issue is, right? So the more publicity you can get about it, the better. That's why I did it, right? To get publicity. If you do it and nobody knows about it, there's no particular point in it. So the more people who know that people are willing to risk jail in order to fight an unjust and dangerous pipeline, I think it's better.
In a recent article that you kind of spoke about your privilege being in jail, but you actually spoke on there was other detained women in the prison that you also thought were political prisoners. So can you explain why you thought that?
Oh, so I was in there for, in my opinion anyway, I was in there for protesting an unjust law, that the laws that enable Trudeau to go ahead with the pipeline to buy it. There have been lots of other unjust laws in the history of the country and the world, like slavery was permitted by unjust laws, the theft of indigenous land was permitted by unjust laws. So here I am in prison, and there's all these beautiful women in there who are so nice, you know, making bracelets for each of us, sharing their shampoo, giving us tips on how to keep out of trouble with the guards, that kind of thing. And I realize that they're in there because of unjust laws, too. For example, a lot of them are in there because of drug addiction. It's the drug addiction that's gotten them into trouble. And addiction should be a health issue, not a criminal issue. So that's an unjust law. And they shouldn't be in there. In my opinion, there should be other ways of helping them out. And a lot of them were in there because of poverty and homelessness. And those are created by unjust social situations and even unjust laws, like laws that create welfare rates that are too low to live on. Budget laws that create budgets to build housing, but there's hardly been any social housing built that low-income people can afford. So it's all connected.
So, Jean, that actually brings me to my next two questions here. You mentioned in a tweet on August 13th that Vancouver needs free, on-demand access to clean and safe drugs and treatment for people battling opioid addiction. How much can COPE actually deal with an issue like drug decriminalization on the local level when drug legalization and supervised drug consumption sites actually fall under federal and provincial jurisdiction?
Yeah, so that's a huge difference between me and other candidates, or it was in the by-election anyway. So a lot of times a candidate will say, well, we have this problem in the city, but our hands are tied because another level of government is responsible for it. So what we're seeing in COPE is if another level of government is responsible for it, they should deal with it, or they should give the city the power to deal with it. So that's what we're going to keep pushing for, and you have to push really, really hard. And there have been people in Vancouver who have done this pushing by setting up illegal safe consumption sites, which is a form of civil disobedience, among other things. So that's the type of actions that we can continue to support. It says in the city charter that one of the roles of councillors is to advocate for their levels of government, so we can do that. Use the city hall structures, staff, space.
How specifically would you be using city hall to do that?
So, you know, there's different things you could do. Like if you're an elected person and someone has set up an illegal safe injection site, you can go down and support them and do a few volunteer shifts, right? You can write letters and meet with people at other levels of government and say, this is what we need, and bring the people on the front line to meetings with people in other levels of government and say, this is what we need. You can use City Hall staff to do research to prove that this is what we need. You can have motions, put forward motions, and encourage delegations to come up and speak in favor of those motions and try and get publicity for it, which will educate people as to the need for clean and safe and free drugs and treatment on demand, those kinds of things. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it definitely does make sense. What I'm hearing, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, but it sounds like a lot of the action that can be taken is still through activism or mostly symbolic political ways. Would that be like an accurate assessment?
Well, have you heard of the Fear? Well, maybe some of your listeners probably haven't heard of the Fearless Cities movement. It's a movement of cities where the councillors want to actually use city government to support social and environmental movements. Barcelona is one, Valparaiso, Chile, Jackson, Mississippi. One of our candidates, Derek O'Keefe, went to a Fearless Cities conference. I think it was in New York a week or two ago. So yeah, it's a whole different concept. It isn't the concept of, oh, a city councilor gets elected and then they're the decision maker and they're like the king and they do what they want to do. It's somebody gets elected and they work with the movements to use all the power they can to get what we need for the city and for people in it, and to get more justice, social and environmental justice.
Okay, awesome. Thank you so much for clarifying that, Jean. A question kind of tying back into social housing for you. Can you tell us, you've been a strong advocate for social housing all throughout your activism career, and can you tell us a bit more about the specifics of this? For example, like, would you like to see social housing built entirely by the government, or would you want to mandate that new developments have a certain percentage of welfare rate social housing, a combination of both? What's your vision there?
So I would make it a priority to work for social housing, which would be housing that would be owned by a government or a nonprofit. And the reason for this is because that's the only way to keep it out of the speculative market. And so what we've said is we would target the people who are most in need first and then kind of work up the need ladder. So the first people that we would try and get housing for are people who are homeless, because they have about half the life expectancy as other people, and it would be nice to get them in housing so they could live as long as other people and have decent lives. But the difference between what we're proposing and what other parties are proposing around homelessness is we actually have a source of revenue to build the housing that's needed, and that's a mansion tax. We're calling for a mansion tax on houses worth over $5 million, on the value of houses worth over $5 million. So if your house is worth under $5 million, there would be no increase. And so what we do is push the province to either give the city revenue for housing from a mansion tax like this, or give the city the power to initiate the tax itself. So in the first year, if you had a tax on mansions over $5 million, the kind of tax we were proposing, you could eliminate, you could build housing for all of the over 2,000 homeless people that were counted in Vancouver in the last homeless count. And then in the next years, you could start building social and co-op housing for low-income renters who are being priced out of the rental market. So in addition to that, we're calling for a rent freeze. That would mean that landlords wouldn't be able to raise the rent the annual 4%, and it would also mean that they wouldn't be able to raise the rent as much as they like when tenants leave or die or get evicted. So that would be huge if we could get it. That's provincial, but it would be something that we could push for with different groups that are representing tenants. The idea of saying that a certain percentage of new development has to be rental housing or has to be social housing isn't really that good sometimes, because in order to get the developers to agree, you have to give them higher density, and that means that a lot of times you gentrify the surrounding buildings, like Woodward's did in the Downtown East Side, because it had so many high-income condos. So you have to be really careful about that kind of inclusionary zoning. There might be some cases where it would work, but it's certainly not the solution to the housing crisis.
Right. Do you think a big increase in social housing would affect demand in the free market for market rate housing and therefore hurt developers?
Well, it probably wouldn't that much, because developers aren't going to build housing for the bottom half of income earners because there's no profit in it.
You know, moving back here, Jean, I just want to kind of touch upon your protesting here again. But, you know, you've tied the Trans Mountain pipeline with Vancouver issues like poverty, homelessness, and the obvious one, climate change. So can you tell us more about these issues and how they correlate?
Yeah, so it really struck me that they correlated when Trudeau decided that he was going to buy the pipeline. I mean, they correlated before that because, of course, the pipeline, the purpose of the pipeline is to take Alberta tar sands, dirty oil, to markets in China and other places so they can be burned and contribute to global warming. So who is affected by global warming? Well, it's predominantly poor and vulnerable people around the world. I mean, there's people in some places of the planet will probably have to be abandoned because they'll become too hot. We've already seen floods. We've seen record temperatures all over the world. Climate refugees, we'll have millions, hundreds of millions of climate refugees, and they'll be the poorest people, the ones that can't afford air conditioning. And then here in our country, it's the same. Who is affected the most by climate change. It's people that can't afford air conditioned earth. It's people that can't afford, that are having to breathe all the horrible air that we're seeing right now. Yeah, so that's, so climate change affects the poor and vulnerable throughout the world first. So that was the connection for me.
So we're just going to do a little switch back here, but COPE wishes to install a mixed ward system in Vancouver. So what are the benefits you see to this system versus installing a conventional ward system or keeping the current at-large system?
Well, the current at-large system is horrible. If you look at this, the city has about six areas for federal and provincial candidates. So if you're running federally or provincially, you only have to target about a sixth of the city. But if you're running in the city, in the at-large system, you have to have enough money to get a leaflet to something like 400,000 houses. I mean, this is ridiculous. For one thing, an at-large system means you have to have a lot of money to run, which, of course, eliminates people who appeal to, or greatly reduces the ability of people who appeal to lower-income people to get elected. So I've been fighting for a ward system for decades because it means that areas where you have, say, low-income people would be able to pick a candidate who would represent their interests. So that would be my preference, would be to have a ward system so that we could do that, and so that it would be easier for people who aren't rich to get elected.
Fantastic. And just one more question here for you, Jean. How does this election, in your experience, compare to your Vancouver's 1988 election in which you ran for mayor?
That was a pretty funny election in retrospect. I was the alleged unity candidate between COPE and the NDP. I say alleged because there was no unity. And I had no campaign team except for Mel Lahan, who was my campaign manager. And it was the first time for both of us, and we knew nothing. And we had hardly any budget. But I still got 45,000 votes, and Gordon Campbell got 75,000. But anyway, so now we have a huge team. We have great enthusiasm. We have a lot of skilled people. We have a great platform, the mansion tax, the rent freeze, ending homelessness, working towards free transit. And we have a lot of support, so it's totally different this time. We have hundreds of volunteers. People are out door knocking and getting our petition signed, and yeah, it's way different.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today, Jean. And good luck with everything. Good luck with your campaign. Good luck with all the stuff coming up in the next few months.
Okay. Thank you, 3As. Thank you for doing this.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye, Jean. Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening. This interview is conducted by Andy Laidman and Aiden Tong. Researchers by Andy Laidman, Aiden Tong, and Alex DeBoer. Editing by Zubin Shroff-Marabidi, Alex DeBoer, Andy Laidman, Aiden Tong, and me, Alam Dialanian.
CITR Radio 101.9 FM and Discorder Magazine present
The Victory Square Block Party 2018.
We're back with our annual free all-day party to bring summer to a close. Happening on Sunday, September 2nd from 1 to 9 p.m. in Victory Square Park at the corner of Cambie and Hastings. With performances by La Casquivana, Princess Apparently, Sorry Edith, Future Star, Mama Rude Gal, Club Sofa, Yep, and Devours. Plus an ice cream truck on site and a raffle for kick butt local prizes.
Discorder, that free magazine from CITR, has been documenting the best in music, arts, and culture since 1983. Let's see what one man of prestige has to say about Discorder.
What up, though? This is Big Snoop Dogg, and I fucks with Discorder magazine. How about that?
Smoke every day.
Pick up a copy around Vancouver or f*** with Discorder online at discorder.ca.
All right. And that was Gene Swanson. Well, those were some ads. That was Snoop Dogg. And before that, you heard an interview with Gene Swanson conducted by Andy Laidman and Aiden Tong. And so Gene is running for city council with the party, the Coalition of Progressive Electors, also known as COPE, which is Vancouver's sort of leftmost party. The election is on October 20th. If you didn't catch it at the beginning, Jean also ran for mayor in 1988 with COPE. So she has a long history of involvement in Vancouver's municipal politics. She worked closely as an activist and politician with Social Democrat and former COPE city councillor and mayoral candidate Harry Rankin, who recently had a documentary released about him. It came out in Doxa called The Rankin File. It was really good. I've seen it. So if that's still playing, which it is sometimes, I think, at Van City, I would recommend checking it out. So we're going to wrap up the show. We have, as usual, a bit less than an hour of content, which is because we are focusing so much of our effort on our podcast, Seeking Office. Hopefully you're all listening to Seeking Office. If you're not, you can find it to download or subscribe on Stitcher, iTunes, Google Play. We're thinking about putting it on SoundCloud. It just takes time, and that is something we do not have a lot of. So right now, we are working on an audio documentary on Vancouver's electoral system, which is, I think I may have talked about last week. Will it ever end? Will we ever finish it? We don't know. We don't know. No, we will. It'll be out on like Monday or something. We're going to send out some press releases. It's going to be good. It's part two of our How We Got Here series, which is meant to provide historical and social context to Vancouver so that everyone can kind of better understand the city they live in, so that when you go to vote, you can understand like what you actually want to change, what's good and what's bad about our electoral system and government. So that's about it. This interview that you just heard with Gene Swanson, I think we were going to make a joke about her being a hardened criminal now.
Jesus Christ.
She spent 4 days in the slammer. So yeah. Anyway, some sort of joke about her being an ex-con. You can find that wonderful interview on our podcast, Seeking Office. It should be up tomorrow. So we're going to continue to every Thursday have interviews with local politicians or people relevant to the municipal election, and then have those interviews available on our podcast, Seeking Office, thus producing content weekly so that you don't forget about us. So please download Seeking Office, and thank you very much for listening to us. We will be back next Thursday with more Democracy Watch brought to you by the News Collective. Have a great night.